Hi there, it's Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4. We brought London, but we're not in London, we're in New York.
New York, greatest city on earth. We have an amazing view from our hotel. I'm so happy. And of course, we are here because finally, it's the final few days of the election. What do you think of that?
Well, yeah, it's been an epic election journey. Anyone in America can become president. And with this year, somebody who people didn't imagine would ever run for president, ran for president, and is now within a few points of leading the polls as we head into the election. That, of course, being Donald J. Trump against Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I think it's very exciting. I'm a big Trump supporter because I think the whole system needs to be scrubbed and we start again.
Well, I don't support either candidate. I think they're dangerous in their own unique way, but I'm not sure you can end up running for president and really not be dangerous. The position itself is dangerous. It's a fading empire. Or I like this term, and we're going to use this in one of the Kaiser reports this week, that Stephen Jay Cohen talked about regarding a word in Russian, which the Russians fear, and that is the collapse of the state. And in Russian, they say shmuta, shmuta.
Oh, yeah.
And this happened in 1917 and again in 1991 when every institution and edifice of the state collapsed. This is something they fear. And this is something I see here, but it's a collapse of an empire with many tentacles around the world and bases and, you know, military bases, hundreds of military bases. So that's why I think it's the position itself is inherently dangerous. But we spent the past 2 weeks in the battleground state. And it's the battleground state of North Carolina. And the reason why it's a battleground state is because there is no path to victory for Trump without winning North Carolina. So that is the mission of Obama, Biden, Michelle, Hillary, Kane. They're all down there trying to prevent Trump from winning that state. 15 electoral college votes. You know that the Democrats have a natural advantage in the electoral college because they always get California and New York. California has 55. New York has 29 electoral college votes. That puts them, you know, almost half of the way there. So they just need to win those two states and then pick off a few other states. But yeah, it was looking good for Trump, by the way, in Chatham County, which is traditionally quite Democrat.
Yeah, well, we spent a lot of time in North Carolina. And it's interesting. It is the battleground state. It's a pivotal state. It's a deciding state. And it also resonates with the history of America because in that state you have a lot of dynamics, both demographic and psychographic, in play and historical. This is a state that we learned from our friend Randy Valor, that plays a key role in the Civil War in America, which of course is a war for the freedom of the slaves, basically. And so the dynamics of the black community is very much in play there. The history of the end of slavery and the rise of the post antebellum South. All these things are quite interesting, and I found that very, very textually informative. That this you know, we lose track of the historical significance. You know, we tend to speak in terms of sound bites, and with these race issues, they become ones where you have battling hashtags, and you lose the context. I mean, North Carolina provides the context. It's part of the Civil War, which is part of the history, and the concept of the three-fifths chattel law, which is codified in the Constitution of the United States, where, in other words, the U.S. was born of a poisoned chalice, if you will. There was, as the U.S. became a nation, they had the makings of the Civil War and the makings of this possible electoral catastrophe that we're looking at. And it was all baked into the cake, I guess you could say, based on going back to this three-fifths chattel law, Stacey.
Yeah, and we learned that North Carolina was the last state to join the Confederacy, to sign on for the Civil War. They were very reluctant to do it, especially in the Chatham County area, which is up in the north part of the state. So it's kind of like the dividing state between North and South in a way, in that the northern part of the state is quite liberal and the southern part of the state is quite southern and not liberal. It's interesting to see. We've driven up and down north to south a few times, and it's almost like there's a marking point. You can see it.
Yeah, let me ask you this, return to this three-fifths chattel law thing. So if I understand it correctly, when they were dividing up after the Civil War, trying to figure out what the power various states had, the states in the South, you know, it was based on a census, you know, the population. So the states in the South, they wanted to include slaves as part of the population, so that they would have increased power, but they didn't want to give the slaves any power. So they said that they were three-fifths power, or they do you recall the specifics?
So here is, according to Google, the population of slaves, it's called the three-fifths compromise.
Oh, right.
So this is when they were deciding how many House of Representative members each state would have, and it was according to population.
But in what year was that?
This was in 1787.
Okay, so it's part of the constitutional post-revolution.
Post-revolution, it was in the Constitutional Convention of 1787. By the way, that's when your family arrived from Scotland, 1787.
Oh, yeah, of course. We were there. We heard it was America was a good place to go.
Well, your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was only 12. He arrived in 1787. The population of slaves would be counted as three-fifths of a human in total when apportioning representatives, as well as presidential electors and taxes. The three-fifths compromise was proposed by James Wilson. So, you know, say states like Louisiana or Alabama or Mississippi or, you know, Virginia or you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, they would have a huge population of black slaves and not as many white people. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to make sure that they had as many representatives as say, Pennsylvania, and by counting their chattel as votes, even though slaves obviously couldn't vote.
Right. Right, right. Okay, that clears it up. So, that's the original sin that people speak of in the American formation that resulted in the perpetual deep race divide that we've seen throughout American history. You know, many people deny that there is this deep racial divide. I mean, we have the group Black Lives Matter, and people will say on mainstream media point blank that there's no racism in America. And yet the entire, you know, there's a deep vein of racism runs throughout the entire history. Also, I was talking to somebody recently about this idea of where England abolished slavery, you know, before America did. And there was this huge transference of wealth to the slave owners and bequeathed to them, I guess, by the crown. And I was curious about that because there was no revolution. There was not a bloody uprising. They simply, as I understand it, abolished slavery. There was money was transferred, and that was the history of it. The point was made to me, I guess it was Randy Voller, again, who made the point, and this is a former four-time mayor of Pittsboro in North Carolina who we've become friends with. He was saying, well, a lot of these folks who did get a huge payout from the crown for ending their slaves, turned around and made investments in America, which was still in the slave business. So it was a slave arbitrage, if you will, which I found interesting.
Well, North Carolina does, you know, everybody's talking about rigging elections. That is the big topic in this election. It's the conspiracy theory election. And everybody has their conspiracies about who's rigging the elections. Of course, Donald Trump is saying that you know, individual states are going to rig the election for Hillary. Hillary says Russia's going to rig the election. But the fact is, okay, so when we were in North Carolina, We were in the 4th Congressional District of North Carolina, and that is the 7th most gerrymandered district in all of the hundreds across the U.S. So if you look at it, we covered this on Kaiser Report a few days ago, it makes this county look very bizarre. It's not just, you know, you think of a county and you look at a map of a country and you just divide it up into various equal sizes of population, right? No, it looks like, you know, a demented snowflake sort of thing. It's not an asymmetric, beautiful snowflake. It's like a mutant snowflake. And this is a form of rigging, I think, because it guarantees there's been so much gerrymandering across the U.S. that that's why you have basically parties rule every single district, many, many districts. So the incumbent will always win. So there's that. But there's also the voter suppression, which is a form of rigging. And North Carolina does have a big problem with that, of trying to find ways to prevent Black people from voting, because Black people the African American population tends to vote Democrat. So it's often the Republicans seeking to keep them from being able to vote, finding new ways to prevent them from voting.
Yeah, I mean, that's another part of this racist history. Two points. Number one, predominant population in American prisons is Black, and when you go into the prison system, you lose your right to vote. You come out and you no longer can vote either, as I understand it.
Each state has their own ability to determine whether or not a former convict, a felon, could vote. So, for example, in Virginia, it's run by the governor's Terry McAuliffe, who is a good friend of Hillary Clinton. And you know what he did right before this election in this summer? He made it so all former felons can vote. Okay. Now, so there's like 2 million.
Right. And so in some states it's not. And certainly when you're in the jail, you cannot vote. In some countries in Europe, if you're in jail, you can still vote. Sure. But here you can't vote. And so there's an incentive to put Blacks in jail if you want to vote in ways that would disenfranchise the Black community, consistent with a long-term historical racist streak. And then, as you're saying, the gerrymandering or the disenfranchising of Blacks to vote in ways where requiring ID, for example, in ways that would guarantee preclusion of large parts of the Black community, and that's just institutionalized racism. And yet they still, you know, believe on a certain level and a mainstream media level that, you know, they are in denial about this racist streak.
Yeah, but judges across the U.S. yesterday overturned a few of these, including North Carolina. They had, it was apparently some guy, some activist over the past few years has been looking at the voter rolls and sending letters, and it turns out to mostly Black areas. And see if he gets any letters back saying addressee unknown. Mm. He goes and says this person doesn't live there, and they remove the person from the list. There were something like 4,000 voters that he had managed to get off the rolls. So they said the judge ordered North Carolina to return those people to the voting rolls. They might be people who have no intention of voting anyway, but there's that. So anyway, yeah, we've spent a lot of time in this area, and I was surprised at, because it's a university area, so you have University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, you also have Duke University, and it's called the Research Triangle, so you have Durham, Raleigh, Cary, and, you know, it's a very, you know, educated, intellectual population, and I expected a few more. I know you don't think that, you know, that maybe Hillary supporters are more online, and certainly it does look like that, but there were a lot of Trump signs that I was surprised at, because even like that town of Pittsburgh that you talked about, 6,000 voters there. Obama won it both in 2008 when he won the state and in 2012 when he lost the state to Romney, and he won it both times. And what we saw there, I saw a heavy skewing to Trump signs versus Hillary signs. But maybe people are just afraid to put Hillary signs out. I don't know.
Well, I'm sorry, but what do you say?
I'm just surprised that I saw so many Trump support.
Oh, yeah, sure. A lot of Trump support out there. And he's very close to the polls, just a few points away.
Yeah, well, he's actually been leading in some of them. So I guess also the financial markets, the S&P 500 was down again. This is the longest losing streak since 1980. I think 8 or 9 days in a row that it ended down. Everybody's blaming the election, this uncertainty, and the fact that it looks like Trump could possibly win, that there's even a path to victory, because even a week ago, there was no path to victory. And now it's looking like there's a, you know, as more of the early voting stuff comes in, it looks like there has been a, that Hillary's underperforming Obama in states like Florida, North Carolina, in terms of the number of people going out to vote, that there's a bigger share of white voters versus Latino and African American. There's also the fact the FBI investigation, which has been reopened in the past week. So they're saying, you know, people online and people like on Bloomberg.com and CNBC say that the markets are concerned that it's going to be Trump that could possibly win, and that if Hillary wins, the markets will have one of the biggest rallies in history.
Yeah, well, you know, David Stockman was on TV recently just saying that he doesn't see a way, a path out of chaos, that Hillary will be mired. He said, he called it Nixon 2.0, I think is what he said. So she'll be mired in problems from day one because of all the WikiLeaks reveals and the FBI and the investigation and the coming indictment. So she'll be indicted and under investigation by the FBI as a sitting president, and that, of course, means that she won't be able to do much as president. And so if she wins, she loses. Now, if Donald Trump wins, then there's we lose too, because here's a guy with no experience who's going to be who knows, it's a huge question mark. I like the idea. I think, you know, America's dynamic enough that they can take the somebody who's a neophyte. I mean, Barack Obama was had been in the Senate, I guess, for one term, very young guy. He had no experience in Washington at all. And he certainly was not the worst president in American history. He effectively didn't do anything, but except mollycoddle the bankers. But so why not Trump? I'm sure is the way that the system is designed. It's designed that any citizen can be this bureaucrat, essentially, just follow the Constitution. That's what it's there for. You're not supposed to just make stuff up every day. You just make sure that people follow the Constitution. And so it's designed for folks to give their public service for 4 years or 8 years and then go back to their farm or go back to their job. And you're not supposed to have career politicians, 30 or 40 year people in the Senate, in the Congress, sitting there for their entire lives. That's not the way it was designed.
I know. You know, I left the U.S. 20 years ago, and it was I left when Chris Dodd and Joe Lieberman were senators for Connecticut. And, you know, they were senators for Connecticut most of the time I was gone. That was annoying. But, yeah, that's the thing about a Hillary Clinton victory is, remember, the first Obama term, the Democrats controlled the Senate. They had something like 58 of the seats. It was a huge skew in the Senate that they controlled. I think it was close in the House. But this election, the forecasts are for the Republicans will have 52-48 for Democrats in the Senate. So the Republicans will control the Senate and they'll also control the House. So what is the second most hated presidential candidate in history? And Hillary may be the second most after Trump in terms of the population hating them. But Hillary is definitely the most hated by politicians. You know, the Republican politicians hate her so much that I just don't see any sort of pleasant outcome to these next few years. I'm pretty certain she'll win, mostly because of the, well, that Trump hasn't really seemed to run a presidential campaign until the past week, and that the Electoral College favoring the Democrats. So I just see from day one, literally day one, there's so much. She just admitted, and Zero Hedge is running a big story about it, that she accepted a $1 million donation from mm-hmm. Qatar while she was Secretary of State, which she had promised she wasn't supposed to do, and this is suggests corruption. Then there's the I think the biggest story of the past week was that $500,000 that Terry McAuliffe gave to the wife of the FBI agent in charge of the Hillary Clinton email investigation. Mm-hmm. I think that's like shocking, and it hasn't got that much news because there's been so much other crazy stuff going on, mostly planted stories by, I think, the Clinton campaign about these, you know, they really jumped the shark with these crazy stories. You could tell they so jumped the shark that none of the UK press even picked it up. But that this notion that Trump's server was connected to Alpha Bank, which is close to Putin. Mm-hmm. And it was so thoroughly, embarrassingly debunked. And yet they kept on doubling down on it. And Hillary was tweeting about it and saying, we must look at this. And it was really embarrassing. It was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I was watching CNN yesterday and Wolf Blitzer on his show, The Situation Room. And they spent like 4 or 5 minutes talking about this Trump Russia connection in terms that was were just this is the common wisdom that Trump is connected in this way, and it's embarrassing to watch because it's like watching if you watched someone like Edward R. Murrow giving the news report and then suddenly lapsing into reading the script from a Bugs Bunny cartoon without any change in tone, or there was no subtitles to suggest that this is a parody or this the man has just had a stroke or something. So he just said, like Wolf Blitzer saying, oh, and then in South Carolina is winning. Then without skipping a beat, it's like, and the Russian Trump server, you know, like what crazy Kool-Aid drinking nonsense is this? So it's pretty bizarre. Now, if you look at the scandals between the two candidates, okay, Trump's had some sleazy business deals, and he's caught making unflattering remarks in private by undercover microphones. Contrast that with Hillary, who has been caught peddling state secrets, doing deals with dictators, violating numerous laws, and acting like a tin pot dictator in a highly dangerous way. So you can't compare the two. Trump is a schmuck occasionally. So yeah, big freaking deal. It means almost absolutely nothing. The words caught on tape that he's uttered privately, maybe if we were living in 1950 and this was still Ozzie and Harriet land and Leave It to Beaver and Richie Cliff or Cliff Richards, that would be relevant. But we're living in an age where gangster rappers are heard on auto commercials talking about, you know, blah, 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 their hoe, blah, blah. You know, it's absurd.
I actually saw some tweets going by that, you know, Jay-Z performed in, I think it was Ohio last night with Hillary, you know, at a Hillary event. And he was dropping F-bombs all the time. And people were saying, I bet you Hillary's not happy.
That before it happened, that, okay, they're putting on a rapper on the Hillary Clinton. Hillary's upset that Trump used a phrase. Listen to the rap songs of the featured artists on their campaigns. This is detailed, you know, rape, glorifying rape and murder. And yet that somehow that's okay.
Now, I want to go back to this whole, you know, crazy conspiracy theories, true tinfoil hat sort of stuff about trying to make a connection between Trump and Russia that does not exist. And yet the Hillary emails show very clearly, she states herself in emails to Podesta that Qatar and Saudi Arabia fund ISIS. She talks about them funding ISIS and that we need to get them to stop funding it so much.
Right.
And yet here she accepts $1 million from Qatar, and she accepted the foundation accepted $25 million from Saudi Arabia. And now the spin by her people, her surrogates in the press, were that, well, Saudi Arabia is charitable donation. They love charity. They want to help women and people with HIV. And you're like, okay, well, Saudi Arabia yesterday just announced that they're executing a poet for some poem that was bad for Islam or something like that. So had that story been like Putin was had arrested a poet and he was going to be fined for a bad poem, people would be like, the press here would, because of the propaganda, would be treating it as if it were he were executing a poet for some sort of disgraceful poem. Mm-hmm. And yet there was zero shrieking here, even though your next president is accepting millions of dollars from this guy who's executing a poet.
Yeah, what is it, cognitive dissonance?
I don't know what it is. It's just so crazy.
Christ, you know, when you willfully allow your mind to separate two mutually opposing ideas and consider there to be no opposition to these ideas, Hillary Clinton and is supporting the funders of ISIS. That's the fact. If to try to cleave your thinking in a way to create the cognitive dissonance needed to pretend otherwise is a hallmark of psychosis. Now, if you were to meet a homeless person who spoke in these psychotic ways, you would be concerned for their mental health, and rightfully so. When you meet Hillary Clinton, who's spouting the same psychotic, schizophrenic, mentally deranged, duplicitous nonsense, why do you go along with it unless you yourself are also equally deranged? And, oh, wait a minute, that's a huge part of the American electorate who will refuse to admit that they are deeply psychotic, deeply racist, deeply Russophobic, and this is what's leading to the rise of Trump. And as David Stockman suggests, and it's hard to disagree, that no matter what the outcome of the election, we're entering into an era of a bit of, that seems a bit chaotic. And the stock market, which is a discounting mechanism, it always tries to discount in the present future risk, future liability, future cost. So it's looking at this and saying, wait a minute, you know, maybe we're a little high, and historically we are high. Let's start raising cash. And so you've had 9 straight down days, which is haven't seen since 1980. And you know, price precedes news. That's an old Wall Street axiom. So the prices are telling us that there's a possible news event and a series of news events that would be negative to the stock market.
Yeah, well, the price seems to be suggesting Trump is going to win. But we have 1 minute left, and I want to say now we can turn to Brexit, because I knew your head would pop if we talked about it. But, of course, these three judges said that Theresa May cannot just invoke Article 50. Parliament needs to do it. Your thought in the last 40 seconds.
As I said from day one, that why are you Brexiting? And you're still subject to the Queen. So here we are after the vote, and finally the truth is coming out. The Prime Minister can't just Brexit, okay? The laws are made in Britain by the Queen and Parliament, and the Prime Minister cannot just go around it. And now the parliamentary precedence is being reimposed. And this whole Brexit hoax is being revealed as a horrific sham.
Well, that's it for this episode of Truth About Markets on Resonance 104.4 FM, coming to you from the greatest city on earth, New York City.
Bye, y'all.